Today is August 13th. This is Kathy coming to you with the Decatur Herald and Review for today. I'm on the first page, and it says, Little Learners Take a Big Step. First School Day by Few Tears, Many Hugs by Valerie Wells. Michael Smith was not at all sure he wanted to go to school. His mom, Janae, gently disentangled his hand from hers and nudged him toward a staff member at Pershing Early Learning Center, who assured him we're going to have so much fun as she led him away. Wednesday was the first day for Decatur Public Schools, and at Pershing, an extra-large class of three-year-olds had their first day of school ever. This is his first year, Smith said. I'm a little concerned because he's never had to be away from me. So as you could see, he was crying and falling out, but I hope he has a good day so I don't have to come back and get him. She jokingly called it ripping off the Band-Aid to send him to school and letting him get used to being away from her and her being away from him. She peeked through the window to watch him as he walked away with a staff member. She said she's excited for him and thinks if he has fun, he'll like school, and that's exactly what teachers hope for their students, too. I get to play all day, said Komiko Lewis, teaching assistant at Pershing, who is in the process of getting her teaching certification, studying for her master's in early childhood education. She has run a daycare, driven a school bus, and worked as a teaching assistant, so she knows the returning students and is looking forward to getting to know the new ones, too. Superintendent Nicole Nash Moody first dropped her own younger children at Johns Hill Magnet School, being Mama Moody, as she calls it, rather than Superintendent Moody, and was a little concerned how her youngest twins would handle a new school, but they took it like champs, she said. They're usually more attached, she said, but they ran up the steps and no tears today. I thought I might drop some tears myself, but it was a great time. Moody greeted teachers and students alike at Pershing with Happy New Year, which made most of them chuckle, and she spent a while visiting classrooms, playing with the youngsters, and making sure staff had everything they needed for the day. I feel excited about the first day, Moody said. In general, I'm always preparing everything for the district before the first day so I can spend the first night before school being Mama Moody. I laid everything out last night, all the clothes for me and the kids, and the lunches packed, so this morning I could be Mama Mode, first day pictures, and all of that. She'd already checked in with the staff, and everybody was doing fine, she said, and it looked like the first day of classes would be uneventful. First days of school are my favorite, said Pershing Principal Sarah Knuppel. They're exciting and nonstop and always different. We're just really looking forward to getting the year started. Preschool's no fun without kids. The first day, she said, the goal is to have fun and to make school a positive experience. Parents had to leave their kids at the door to make the break there and keep any parents who might be fighting emotions from bringing that into the classroom. Children adjust more easily if they don't see their parents being upset, she said. Staff members escorted each child to class individually, many of them telling the kids, we're going to be such good friends, soothing their nerves, and in most classrooms, the little ones set down their new backpacks and supplies and found other children to play with almost immediately. For lots of the kids, it's the first time they've ever been away from their parents, Knuppel said. We want them to feel like school is a safe place, a fun place, and hopefully they'll want to come. And we hope that lasts until kindergarten and second grade and fifth grade so they love coming every single time. And if you want to contact Valerie Wells, you can at 217-421-7982. And this headline reads, Decatur celebrates Ellsworth Dansby Jr. with a statue at the namesake school. Decatur-born artist Preston Jackson remembers when Ellsworth Dansby Jr. and his brother Bobby visited the Jackson family home, that Dansby, known to friends as Jr., would pick up Jackson and his twin sister Priscilla and fly them around. The twins were small children then. A statue of Dansby was unveiled Tuesday at Ellsworth Dansby Jr. Magnet School, a statue sculpted by Jackson, who is known worldwide for his art. The most important thing in our lives as artists and as observers of art are the roots of art in our lives, Jackson said. This has roots in a neighborhood, the neighborhood where I was born. The statue depicts Dansby Jr. holding a small plane in the air, much as he once held Jackson. Dansby, a mechanic in World War II, was always tinkering with something, Jackson said. He would take things apart and put them back together, Jackson said. He built a flying machine out of parts, and that was the talk in the neighborhood. And as he got a little older, he would fly. Not that plane. It was too dangerous, he added, getting a laugh from the audience. The idea for a statue of Dansby for the school was Jack McCoy's, a philanthropist and retired pharmacist who remembers Dansby well from the days when Dansby and his wife would come into Raycraft Pharmacy to have lunch. Raising the $105,000 cost of the statue required some effort, he said. With the Heart of Illinois Community Foundation and Decatur Public Schools Foundation helping push it over the top. The Untold Stories Committee's co-chair, Julia Livingston, said that a school and a statue named for a significant figure like Dansby, who was one of the Tuskegee Airmen, the first African-American military pilots and support personnel in the United States Armed Forces, helps in the effort to highlight contributions of African-Americans to Decatur and Macon County. Today, the unveiling of Ellsworth Dansby Jr.'s statue is what we feel is another example of our community partnerships and how they're key in highlighting African Americans who have really played pivotal roles in our community, she said. The Untold Stories Committee is behind the effort to create an African American Heritage Trail in Macon County and has placed two plaques so far, the first at Dansby Magnet School, the second at Parsons School, named for Judge James Parsons, the first black federal judge. Further installations are in the works and will be announced in due course, she said. Our work has continued with a few murals done by Antonio Burton, a.k.a. Tony Picasso, she said. One is right here in Principal Rita Ellis's school as well, Livingston said. There's a lot more work to do, Livingston said, bringing that history to the community with the support and help of the community. Ellsworth Dansby III was also in attendance at the dedication of the statue of his father. That's very nice, he said. Judge Parsons, I don't think he had anything quite like that. Decatur seems to be getting ready for another positive change. Superintendent Nicole Nash Moody said she'd seen a sneak preview of the statue already, but as she begins her first year as superintendent of Decatur Public Schools, she is inspired by being a part of history. I've read about in history books in school, and as an adult, I've taught history, but seeing one of our schools named after Dansby Jr., and also to see Preston Jackson, she said, I fell in love with Jackson's work along the Peoria Riverfront, and I'm excited to see him in person and see some of his art. I'm so proud of our principal and our community that have come together. Seeing our city officials and our community officials here honoring our great African Americans who have made contributions, and this is an example that this city really does embrace all people. And there's some really nice pictures accompanying this article. One of a group of people in front of the school, but then a close-up of the statue showing his face and holding the airplane with its hands raised up over his head. I think the kids will like this very much. This next article headline, Inflation Slows as Gas Prices Decline by Lucia Mutakani. This is a Reuters article. U.S. consumer prices barely increased in July as the cost of gasoline declined for a second straight month, while underlying inflation was benign, further reducing the odds of an interest rate hike from the Federal Reserve next month. The small rebound in the monthly consumer price index reported by the Labor Department on Wednesday, which was in line with economists' expectations, also reflected marginal gains in the prices of food and apparel, as well as decreases in the costs of hotel rooms and prescription medication. The report followed on the heels of news last week of surprise job losses in July. Still, economists said a rate increase this year remained on the table as inflation runs well above the U.S. Central Bank's 2% target. Inline inflation will keep the no-need-to-hike rates narrative that took hold after last week's jobs report intact, said Ellen Zentner, chief economic strategist at Morgan Stanley Wealth Management. There will be another round of inflation data before the September meeting, so the storyline could still change. The consumer price index edged up 0.1% last month after dropping 0.4% in June, which was the first decline in 6 years, the Labor Department's Bureau of Labor Statistics said. A 0.1% rise in the cost of shelter accounted for about 2/3 of the gain in the CPI, which is the consumer price index. Shelter was restrained by a 3.3% plunge in prices for hotel and motel rooms, likely linked to the end of the FIFA World Cup tournament. That offset a 0.3% increase in owner's equivalent rent. Gasoline prices fell 2.9% after decreasing 9.7% in June. In the 12 months through July, the CPI advanced 3.4% after rising 3.5% in June. July's cooler inflation readings likely offer little comfort to consumers, as prices are still higher than they were a year ago and wages are not keeping up. The high cost of living has soured many Americans' views of President Donald Trump and could weigh on the Republican Party's chances in the November midterm elections that will determine control of the U.S. Congress for the next 2 years. Trump won the 2024 presidential election in large part because of his promise to lower inflation. Excluding the volatile food and energy components, the CPI gained 0.2% last month after being unchanged in June. The so-called core CPI increased 2.5% in the 12 months through July, after climbing 2.6% in June. The Fed tracks the personal consumption expenditure price indexes for its 2% inflation target. Financial markets priced in at about a 40% chance of a rate increase at the Fed's September 15th-16th policy meeting after the CPI data was released, slightly less than earlier in the day. Policymakers will still get August's CPI and employment reports before that meeting. Economists expect the pace of consumer price increases to pick up in August, reflecting the recent increase in oil prices. Job growth is also expected to rebound as seasonal distortions fade. The Fed last month left its benchmark overnight interest rate in the 3.50 to 3.75 range. The dollar slipped against a basket of currencies in early trade on Wednesday. U.S. Treasury yields fell. The United States' position as a net oil exporter and the drawing down of petroleum inventories cushioned the hit on the economy from the oil price shock sparked by the Middle East conflict. But some economists said that can't persist indefinitely. They also added that the U.S. and other nations would at some point need to replenish petroleum inventories, which would keep oil prices elevated. Trump accused Iran of being devious negotiators in an interview released late on Monday and described some of his current options in the war, just bop along and let Tehran fail economically or hit them really, really hard. Inline inflation will keep the no need to hike rates narrative that took hold after last week's jobs report intact. There will be another round of inflation data before the September meeting, so the storyline could still change. And this was an article written by Ellen Zentner, who is the chief economic strategist at Morgan Stanley Wealth Management. Skipping to page 3, judge threatens fines for DCFS. News organization sues for records on death of child in agency's care by Peter Hancock. A circuit court judge in Sangamon County threatened Tuesday to begin assessing daily fines against the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services for its repeated failure to appear in court or comply with orders to hand over documents related to the death of a teenager who was in the agency's care. Judge Jack Davis II issued an order Tuesday for the DCFS Director Heidi Mueller to appear personally at a September 9th hearing to show cause while she and the agency should not continue to be held in contempt over repeated refusals to appear in court or comply with orders to produce records related to the death of an 18-year-old girl who died while in foster care in 2024. Capital News Illinois sued for access to the personnel records of two caseworkers and one supervisor who were responsible for monitoring Mackenzie Femley, the girl who died. According to doctors, Mackenzie died May 11, 2024 from a blood clot that hit her lungs. She was found struggling to breathe at the bottom of the basement stairs in Fairview Heights Foster Home. Doctors reported she died of a blood clot that hit her lungs. Her neck, shoulders, legs, and face were bruised, and her dehydrated body weighed just 90 pounds. Her foster mother, Shamika Williams, and foster grandmother, Cornelia Reed, are charged with murder in connection with Mackenzie's death. Both are currently being held in the St. Clair County Jail. Williams was licensed through the Lutheran Children and Family Services, a nonprofit agency that provides foster care services on contract with DCFS. According to a timeline of the incident released by DCFS, Williams purportedly told an LCFS caseworker during an in-person visit that Mackenzie was struggling 2 days before her death. The caseworker, however, did not document that conversation until 5 days after Mackenzie's death. LCFS later reported the visit was made by phone, not by person. As a part of an investigative reporting project, Capital News Illinois requested copies of the personnel files of two caseworkers and one supervisor assigned to McKenzie's case. DCFS denied that request. In March, Springfield attorney Don Craven filed suit on behalf of CNI and reporter Beth Hulstfer, alleging DCFS violated the Illinois Freedom of Information Act and asked for an order to compel DCFS to produce the records. DCFS did not respond to that lawsuit, and when the case was called for a hearing in June, attorneys for the agency did not appear. On June 10th, Judge Davis issued an order finding DCFS willfully and intentionally violated the Freedom of Information Act when it failed to release the requested information. He also ordered DCFS to produce the records within 5 days and to pay CNI's costs, attorney fees, and a $5,000 civil penalty. After DCFS failed to respond to that order, CNI filed another motion asking the court to order DCFS and Mueller to appear personally and explain the noncompliance with the court's previous order. But when that motion was called for a hearing Tuesday, DCFS again failed to appear. Davis then set another hearing date for September 9th and ordered DCFS and Mueller to appear or face additional sanctions. Davis could then order appropriate course of penalties, including ordering them to pay $1,000 a day for each day of noncompliance. And that was an article from the Capital News Illinois, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service that distributes state government coverage to hundreds of news outlets funded statewide. It is funded primarily by the Illinois Press Foundation and the Robert R. McCormick Foundation. And this from page 8. Trump's approval rating hits record low. President Donald Trump's approval rating fell to yet another low since his return to the White House, according to a new Economist YouGov poll, which also found just 1 in 3 Americans approve of his job performance. The survey released Tuesday found that 33% of Americans approve of Trump's performance, down 3 percentage points from the previous week. This marks the lowest approval rating the president has seen in YouGov tracking since he returned to office in 2025. Additionally, 60% of Americans said they perceived the president as not honest and trustworthy. The newest poll also found 65% of the respondents said the country is headed in the wrong direction, up 2 percentage points from the Economist YouGov's poll in late July. The latest poll found Trump's age continues to concern the American public, with 53% saying they believe the 80-year-old president was too old to be in the White House. The Economist YouGov poll was conducted August 7th through 10th among 1,589 U.S. adults. Its margin of error was plus or minus 3.2 percentage points. Trump's slide in the polls in recent weeks could signify good news for the Democrats ahead of November's midterm elections. In the newest Economist YouGov poll, Democrats hold an 8-point lead over Republicans in a generic congressional ballot. That lead held in other surveys. A poll Marquette Law School released August 5th showed Democrats held a 6-point advantage over Republicans. A survey Reuters Ipsos released August 3rd had the Democratic Party holding a 5-point lead over the GOP. Last week, Trump said the Republican base is angry at the party's leadership in Congress ahead of the midterms. "A lot of them are very angry at Republicans, to be honest with you," Trump said in an interview with Punchbowl News. "They're angry at Republicans, but they're not angry at me." The president's remarks came as he dismissed his current approval ratings by defending his popularity, specifically pointing to his 2024 election wins in several states. "I have records in many states," he said. "The question is, if I don't run, will those people go out and vote? And that's the one thing I can't tell you. I'm going to ask them to." The majority of respondents in the newest poll also said they believe Trump used his presidential powers for his own benefit. According to the Economist YouGov poll, 61% of respondents said they believe Trump used his office for personal gain, and 55% said they believe the president used the Department of Justice to go after his political enemies. Trump's controversial ballroom project at the White House, where he had the East Wing torn down, also remained unpopular with Americans. 57% said they oppose it. And with that comment in mind, I'll go back to page 2 in the report, White House construction to cost at least $900 million. This is from Reuters. Donald Trump's administration is set to spend at least $900 million for construction projects on the White House grounds, the Washington Post reported on Wednesday, citing records. Instead of securing money directly from Congress, the administration has gathered funds from other agencies and private donors and directed them to an account that holds a few million dollars for routine maintenance of the White House, the report said. Confidential contracts and related planning documents indicate that the administration plans to use money in that account for White House modernization products, the report added. Last week, a U.S. federal appeals court ordered the administration to stop construction on a $400 million ballroom on the site of the White House's demolished East Wing, dealing the Republican leader a major setback in a case testing his presidential authority. When asked for comment on the Washington Post report, a White House spokesperson reiterated that renovations to the East Wing are inextricably tied to the security of the president, the White House grounds, and the security infrastructure assets. Trump and other individuals are funding the ballroom to the tune of approximately $400 million, the spokesperson told Reuters. And this is the first photograph I've seen of the White House with the wing in various stages of construction. So you see the White House, but then you see all this metal and debris and lots of cars and trucks around. So yeah, it's going to be a major renovation project. Establishment Crowley beats Progressive Hong by Philip M. Bailey. Democrats' nationwide tug-of-war between the mainstream liberal and more progressive factions continued Tuesday with another neck-and-neck race, this time for the party's nomination for the Wisconsin gubernatorial contest. With more than 95% of the vote counted, Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley, backed by party leaders such as Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers, pulled off a narrow win over a Democratic Socialist State Representative Francesca Hong. Crowley won by less than half a percentage point in an election outcome that no statewide surveys predicted. This marks another significant underperformance by populist outsiders relative to polling, and more proof that the Democratic electorate in key Midwestern swing states is closely divided between its left and center wings. A week after Abdul El-Sayed's razor-thin win over establishment-backed Representative Haley Stevens in the Michigan Senate primary. From day one, this campaign has been about what comes next for Wisconsin, making life more affordable, strengthening our schools, creating good-paying jobs, and making sure opportunity reaches every corner of our state, Crowley said Wednesday on social media. Speaking to supporters late Tuesday evening, Hong stressed that no matter who prevails, the Badger State's politics have changed. We are fighting to become once more what Wisconsin has always been. A place where our future is determined not by corporations and billionaires, but our future that's determined by the working class people who live here. Progressives fared better in neighboring Minnesota, where Democratic primary voters handed Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan a progressive win over Representative Angie Craig, a centrist, in the campaign to replace retiring Senator Tina Smith. That race had many of the same markings as other bitter primaries this year, but was largely shaped around an incident where federal officers shot and killed Renee Good and Alex Pretty, two U.S. citizens in the state this year. There was also a result that defied polling on the Republican side, as President Donald Trump's near-perfect endorsement record took a hit. Controversy-prone Mike Lindell, the former MyPillow CEO, lost to Minnesota State House Speaker Lisa DeMuth in the Republican primary for governor, despite having led in the polls. There are also contests Tuesday in Alabama, Connecticut, Vermont, and South Carolina, where newly appointed Senator Darlene Graham, the sister of the late Lindsey Graham, who died in July, jockeyed against nine other GOP rivals in a special election. Key takeaways from Tuesday's election. The Democrats remain split. Leading up to Election Day, most observers viewed Hong as the favorite, given the massive lead she had in many surveys. But after the polls closed, Hong and Crowley were engaged in an unexpectedly tight contest that underscores how divided Democrats remain over their party's direction heading into the fall. Many Democrats, including Crowley, spotlighted Hong's stumbles during an August 3rd CNN interview that questioned her old social media posts calling for the cancellation of Thanksgiving. She's not ready for prime time, Crowley told USA Today. But others argue those rookie mistakes and previous comments, including calls to abolish the police, were eclipsed by Hong's grassroots support and growing frustrations with the party's establishment. She galvanized her campaign around universal health care, promises to block data centers, and levying higher taxes on the wealthy. The 40-year-old Milwaukee County executive's win is more remarkable when considering that he dropped out of the race in July due to poor polling. But amid Hong's stumbles, he returned to the race, this time carrying Evers' support and endorsement and a larger concern about the presumed frontrunner's abilities to win in November. Francesca Hong is just not a good candidate, and anybody who says otherwise is not necessarily paying attention to the realities of the matter, Democrat Bakari Sellers, a CNN political analyst, told USA Today in an interview last week. Crowley, who would become Wisconsin's first black governor if elected, will face Republican Representative Tom Tiffany, who easily defended a relatively unknown primary opponent. A competitive district. Further down the Badger State ballot, Democrat Rebecca Cook hopes the third time's a charm after easily winning a primary election with the National Party's early support. Representative Derek Van Orden is among the most vulnerable Republican incumbents running for re-election amid a projected blue wave that could flip control of the U.S. House of Representatives. Cook, a nonprofit owner and former server, is hoping that the better political environment will be her edge after failing to get out of the Democratic primary in 2022 and losing to Van Orden by about 3 percentage points in 2024. Democratic strategists noted she outperformed former Vice President Kamala Harris, who lost that district to Trump by about 7 percentage points. Minnesota Progressives. Minnesota's Senate primary to replace retiring incumbent Tina Smith was less visible compared to other Democratic primaries this year, but it featured many of the same tensions that gave progressives a decisive win. Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, cast as the more progressive alternative, was projected as the victor over Representative Angie Craig, a centrist. The outcome is more remarkable when considering Craig had a roughly $20 million advantage, $1 million to a $4.7 million spending advantage over Flanagan, according to Ad Impact. For months now, I've been telling you this campaign was about the many versus the money, Flanagan said during her victory speech. Guess what? The many just won. The two tussled over the influence of wealthy donors and the U.S. support for Israel, while spotlighting support from different wings in their party. But their race focused mostly on the backlash against the Trump administration's immigration enforcement campaign in the Democrat-leading state. That resistance culminated earlier this year in a form of massive protests after federal officers killed Renee Good and Alex Pretty, two U.S. citizens. Craig argued Flanagan was the preferred opponent for Republicans given her ties to a welfare fraud scandal that ended Governor Tim Walz's bid for a third term. The former vice presidential nominee noticeably didn't endorse either contender in this primary. She will face former NFL sideline reporter Michelle Tafoya, who easily won her GOP primary. MyPillow CEO. It is rare that GOP voters don't go with President Trump's picks in a primary. The Minnesota Republicans did by rejecting Mike Lindell's bid for governor. Few mega figures stood by the president as loyally as Lindell, who remains wedded to the false claims that Trump won the 2020 presidential election. The former MyPillow CEO who stepped down to run for governor has been held liable for those denials in federal court. Lindell was the front runner in most of the surveys leading up to Election Day, but observers began to notice a late surge by Minnesota House Speaker Lisa DeMuth that culminated in her decisive 13-point win over Lindell. DeMuth will face Senator Amy Klobuchar, a former presidential candidate who coasted to the Democratic gubernatorial nomination this fall. Darlene Graham glides to victory. As expected, Senator Darlene Graham didn't break a sweat in the August 11th primary to replace her late brother Lindsey Graham against nine other Republican candidates. The 62-year-old political newcomer who was appointed prevailed, carrying about 33% of the vote ahead of well-known names in South Carolina politics, including former Governor Mark Sanford, along with Representatives Russell Fry and Ralph Norman. That margin of victory falls short of the needed 50% threshold to avoid a runoff, however, which means Darlene Graham will have to run again on August 25th. Norman, 93, who ran for governor in June, outpaced the other contenders to take second place. And that's the end of part one. This has been Kathy reading the first half of the Decatur and Herald Review. The Decatur Herald and Review. I'll be right back with the second half.